Episode 17, Stalingrad. Shells whistle through the air. Great gouts of water erupt from the Volga. The crash of waves, the sound of people shouting, of people screaming, brought back to him the descriptions of hell he'd heard from priests when he was a boy, before the communists took over. It was his turn now. His turn to board one of those thin, rickety boats and get towed over to the ruin that had once been a city. He has no rifle. They told him to pick one up from the dead when his unit gets to the other side. He shuffles up the gangplank towards the fragile-looking boat. On the deck, there's an argument breaking out. A commissar is telling one of his men to get into the hold below the deck. The man is refusing, shouting back that if they get hit, anyone in the hold will drown. Their voices get louder. Then, in one smooth motion, the commissar pulls out his pistol and fires two shots. The man falls into the Volga. The commissar barks at the men to get aboard. They're crossing the Volga now. They hear the scream of a Stuka. It dives, strafes the boat next to them. It starts to sink. Men fling themselves out like rats. Some sink, some swim. Spray from shells coats the deck of the barge he's on. They're almost there. Almost to a different hell. Almost to Stalingrad. Welcome to The Finest Half Hour, read by Richard Cutland, written by Jim Jager, and brought to you with the generous support of Wargaming. Today we're going to tell the tale of one of the most important battles of the Second World War, a tale of resistance and perseverance, of brutality and repression, of struggle and sacrifice. It is a clash of nations, a clash of wills, and a clash of egos. It is the Battle of Stalingrad. The year is 1942. Leningrad has turned into a siege. The Wehrmacht is being turned back from the gates of Moscow. But in the south, something different is occurring. The German army is still pushing forward. This is the area that Hitler cares about. More than Moscow, Hitler wants the oil fields in the Caucasus. Over the course of 1941, his armies have pressed through southern Ukraine and into Russia. They've met with delays due to the winter, the Rasputitsas and pockets of stubborn resistance, like the garrison at Sevastopol, which held out far longer than anyone expected. But by the summer of 1942, they were on the march again, turning south, towards the oil that Hitler needed to keep his armies running. The plan, Operation Blau, was to march through Grozny and on to the oil fields at Baku, all the way into Azerbaijan. But at the northern edge of this southern front, there sat a city right on the Volga. It wasn't an important city. It had some industry and was a pass-through point for some of the supplies coming from the Lend-Lease program. But really, its only strategic value was that it served as a good anchor point for the German line. If it could be taken, it could be used to block Russian reinforcements coming from the east from flanking the Wehrmacht's push to the south. It wasn't a well-known city, or one that most of the commanders on the southern front had given much thought to until the campaign began. But the city had a name, an important name, a portentous name. It was called Stalingrad. Hitler seized on this. He would take Stalingrad. He would conquer the namesake of his greatest foe. Goebbels, the Nazi propaganda minister, started to play it up. The city represented the clash between cultures, between nations. It represented the might of the two dictators. It was a proxy for their personal feud. The question of who was the stronger man would be decided by the possession of Stalingrad. And as Nazi propaganda started to play up the importance of the city, it started to take on more and more importance in Stalin's eyes. This is where the showdown would be. The Wehrmacht pressed through southern Ukraine, seizing Sebastopol after a lengthy siege, crossed the Don River, and pushed into the Caucasus. On the northern end of the front, Stalin threw several hundred thousand hastily assembled troops at the Germans to try to turn them back before they ever reached Stalingrad. Like most of Stalin's assaults to date, this counterattack was shattered at the cost of enormous losses for the Soviet Union, but it did bloody and delay the German army. The Soviets used this time to drive cattle and ship all grain east, denying the Wehrmacht food, but also leaving Stalingrad itself desperately short of supplies. Despite this, even as the German army approached the city, Stalin ordered that Stalingrad not be evacuated. The civilian populace was not removed. They were trapped in a city about to experience the full horror of war. And while many volunteered to fight for their homes and their families, regardless of their feelings about the Soviet Union, many others were simply conscripted. If they didn't fight on the front line, they were sent to build weapons in the factories or dig the trenches. Then, towards the end of July, Stalin issued his famous "not one step back" order. Anyone retreating without orders was to be court-martialed or shot. Stalingrad was to be held, no matter the cost. August 1942, outskirts of Stalingrad. "Set inclination to 0 degrees," she said, and they cranked the great anti-aircraft gun to rest parallel to the ground. They knew what was coming. She looked into the eyes of the loader. They had been classmates just a year before. They were 19. They giggled about love and skipped out on school together. It seemed like another lifetime. Now they were both wearing uniforms. She looked around. Many of the girls who went to her school were here, wearing drab brownish green, covered in dust, smeared with the grease of the guns. She could sense their resolve. They weren't children anymore. She let herself feel a moment of self-pity. It was all about the little, foolish things that broke her heart. She missed her dog. It was small and fluffy and a little fat. It wouldn't understand. It wouldn't understand why she didn't come back. It might think that it did something bad, and that was why she wouldn't come and sneak it treats anymore. It was irrational, almost ridiculous to be thinking that in this moment. She knew that. She glanced away from her gun crew so they wouldn't know her thoughts. She shook her head. She was a soldier, and she had a duty to do. She heard the tanks approaching. She nodded to the loader. Her loader nodded back. They were all ready. She let her arm drop. The gun roared. Perhaps someday the motherland would honour them as heroes. For a brief moment in history, Luftflotte 4, the air support for Army Group South, was the most powerful air group in the world. And as August came to an end, they came within range of Stalingrad. For days they pounded the city. Their aim was to soften up the defences so German troops could simply roll through and clean up what was left. But instead they reduced the city to rubble. They turned it into an apocalyptic vision, the nightmare skeleton of a city, with ruined buildings standing as a ghostly reminder of what once had been. And, as the German army would soon find out, in some ways ruins are even easier to defend than intact streets. In a ruined city, it becomes impossible for vehicles to manoeuvre. Every gutted building becomes a place to hide or launch an ambush from, and cover can be found everywhere. So every block can become a new defensive line. If they wanted Stalingrad, the Wehrmacht would have to fight street by street, house by house, room by room. Still, the initial air assault was devastating. Once again, the Luftwaffe swept the Soviet Air Force from the sky, after which they took out many of the ferries transporting troops across the river and flattened most of the housing in the city, forcing soldiers and civilians alike to shelter in cellars and basements for as long as the battle went on. Then ground troops attacked. The Red Army was disorganized. Defenses weren't adequately prepared. In the north, nothing stood in the way of the 16th Panzer Division. All they had to do was secure one of the outlying airports and then they can move at full speed on the city itself. It was a nothing assignment. They just had to drop off a few men to guard the place and move on. Intelligence reported that there weren't even any troops in the area. In the early morning, they began their approach towards the runway, unbuttoned and incautious. Suddenly, a hail of fire met them. Thin-skinned vehicles were torn apart. Troops out of armor were cut down. They returned fire. For hours, the battle raged. They exchanged shot after shot. Every time they took out a gun crew, it would be immediately replaced. The defenders didn't stop firing until the Germans had silenced every single one of their guns, 37 in all. Intelligence hadn't been too far off. There were no infantry or armoured divisions nearby. Only an anti-aircraft regiment, crewed almost entirely by volunteer young women just out of a nearby high school. They had no training in ground combat, and if they were equipped like most such regiments, probably had few armour-piercing shells. And though many of them died at their guns, they held up the German advance and with their lives bought time the Red Army desperately needed to shore up Stalingrad's defence. September 1942, the heart of the city. He threw a grenade down the hallway in front of him, then spun back as two rifle shots cracked out. Wood splintered on the doorframe he'd just been standing in. He pressed himself against the wall. He was in what must have once been a child's bedroom. His breath came raggedly. He listened for the sound of his grenade. He waited a moment, listened again. He hadn't got them. Something was being dragged across the floor. All of a sudden he heard a rattle. Then heavy machine gun rounds pierced through the thin plaster of the wall he was using for shelter. He threw himself to the floor and started to crawl backwards. His unit had camped here overnight. A German unit must have had the same idea. They'd practically walked into one another this morning. Which is how he ended up here, pinned, on the floor of a pale blue nursery, waiting for some cover from the rest of his unit, or a German round in the head. German soldiers had a joke in Stalingrad. Someone would ask about the status of the front, and someone else would respond, "We've taken the dining room, but there's still heavy fighting in the living room and the kitchen." There's truth in humour. By September, the battle for Stalingrad had devolved to 1,000 tiny close-quarter battles. The Soviets had been pushed back into the city. The Germans had come within shelling range of the Volga crossing. Soviet casualties were extreme. Half of the first wave of men the 13th Guards Rifle Division sent across the Volga were lost before they got to the other side. And another 30% were lost within 24 hours of crossing into Stalingrad. Of the 10,000 soldiers that formed the 13th Guards Rifle Division, only around 300 would ever leave the city. They were part of a force that was sent to retake the Stalingrad train station. Like everything else in the city, this devolved into bitter close-quarter fighting. Men would climb through the rafters and scuttle below the floorboards to surprise their foe. When one part of the station was lost, they would just take the fight to another room or another floor. But the heroic efforts of the 13th Guards Rifle Division and their leader, Alexander Odimtsev, didn't matter. Because like all the other Soviet offences in Stalingrad that September, without air cover, no gains could ever be kept. Which is why, on one of the walls of the train station, you'll find these words, carved with a bayonet. Rodimtsev's guardsmen fought and died for their country here. But every day more and more soldiers were shuttled over the Volga. Countless lives were being pumped into the city. As assaults failed, Russian strategy devolved into one simple commandment: hold everything. It was the manifestation of Stalin's orders not to take one step back. Rather than a grand front, Stalingrad became 1,000 local battles, with every house a fortress, every factory a keep. And in many ways, this played into Soviet strengths. Whether this strategy was adopted consciously or not, it allowed the Red Army to operate on a level that didn't require a finely honed machine. It didn't require highly trained officers or well-drilled men. It just required stubbornness, patriotism, and a daily ration of vodka. And a little fear that if you ran away, someone would put a bullet in your brain. Much of the Soviet army was conscripted. They weren't professional soldiers, and desertions by forced conscripts were common in the hell that was Stalingrad. The enemy line was so close, it made it easy for people to just slip away in the night. So Stalin ordered truly brutal measures to enforce discipline. In fact, the Soviets shot almost as many of their own men as the Americans would lose to German soldiers over the course of the entire war. But that's not to say that in many places Soviet troops didn't put up a heroic resistance. Even if they hated the regime, many fought on with grim determination. At the grain elevators south of the city, 50 Soviet soldiers held off wave after wave of German attacks. For 5 days, they were cut off from the rest of the Red Army as Germans tried to storm their position. 10 times the invaders were repelled. With a dwindling supply of ammo and no access to water, the defenders fought on until they literally began to die of thirst. When they were finally overrun, the Germans were shocked to find only 40 corpses, as they thought they were facing a far larger force. And the story of the Stalingrad factories is incredible. Each of the city's main factories became its own battleground. But even as fighting raged inside the badly damaged factory complexes themselves, Soviet workers still built vehicles and munitions. At one factory, tanks would literally be driven off the assembly line and into battle, sometimes by the workers who built them. At the tractor factory, during the early days of the assault on Stalingrad, when the Red Army was still reeling and trying to organize the city's defenses, the factory workers sallied out and, though lightly armed, beat back a German assault. At the Barricades gun factory, a small detachment of Soviet soldiers under Ivan Lyudnikov held the Germans at bay until mid-November. When the situation in Stalingrad looked its grimmest and they found themselves surrounded with their backs to the river, they held a 500-meter strip of land that would become known the world over as Lyudnikov's Island. It was one of the last toeholds the Soviets possessed west of the Volga until counterattacks could be made to firmly re-establish the Red Army on the western bank of the river. And the Red October factory? Well, we'll get to that in a moment. November to December 1942. Her breath misted in the air. She had sat here for an hour, still, waiting. Then she heard something. The rumble of a great engine. It was a Panzer IV. Not prey for her. Let one of the anti-tank crews hidden in the rubble deal with them. But wait, something was wrong. They were stuck on something. The hatch was opening up. They were coming out in their terrible black suits to see what has happened to their precious tank. She would not let them have even the small satisfaction of knowing. She checked her surroundings one last time. She had been careful to position herself in the shade, where they would not see the glint of her scope. The wind was almost still. Good. That made things easier. She lined up her rifle, accounted for drop, and then... 2 men dropped. She started to sink back into the building she'd been hiding in. It was her rule. 2 shots, no more, then move. It was how you stayed alive here, though she wondered if there would be anything to return to if she managed to live until this war was done. By early November, the situation in Stalingrad had become desperate. German forces controlled almost 90% of the city. Only a few pockets of Soviet resistance remained on the east side of the Volga. One was Lyudnikov's Island. One was the famous Pavlov's House, a 4-story apartment complex looking out over a square. It wasn't a major landmark, or even a building considered to be of much consequence, until a small Soviet squad under one Yakov Pavlov cleared it and decided to occupy it. They were told to hold at all costs, and they took their order seriously. They ringed it with barbed wire, created a minefield around the perimeter, dug trenches 1,200 feet back to the Volga to be able to resupply. They smashed out walls to better be able to communicate, shored up the building with wood beams so it wouldn't collapse under bombardment, and mounted an anti-tank rifle on the roof. It commanded lines of sight for a kilometre in every direction. The Germans couldn't take it. When they tried to assail it with infantry, they found machine guns blazing away at them from the apartment windows. When they brought tanks in to rid themselves of this thorn in their side, they found their armour, normally impervious to anti-rifle fire, was vulnerable to being shot from above. After all, to save on weight and production cost, you armour the top of a tank fairly lightly. You just don't expect to be shot there. Causing even more problems for them, German tanks couldn't elevate their cannons high enough to fire back at the gun on the roof. Soon, Pavlov's house started appearing on Wehrmacht maps in red, simply labelled Fortress. Soviet generals would joke that the Germans lost more men trying to take Pavlov's house than they did taking Paris. Another holdout point was the Red October factory. This massive factory complex was the scene of some of the fiercest fighting in the struggle for Stalingrad. Everyday gains and losses were measured in sheds and factory floors. German and Russian artillery pounded the site. It was bombed day and night. It became a nightmarish spider web of twisted steel and churned earth. Soviet dead here mounted into the thousands. When one building was taken, a counterattack would be ordered, and recruits, fresh off the Volga boats, would charge forward to try to retake it. But slowly, day by day, the Soviets were pushed back. It looked as though Stalingrad might fall. All that the Germans needed to do was sweep up these last few pockets of resistance, desperately clinging to the eastern shore, and the city would be under their control. But then came the winter. November the 19th to February the 2nd, 1942. Flak marked the night sky. This would be the last flight into Stalingrad. Men stood on the runway, emaciated, ragged uniforms hanging off their skeletal frames. They worked by rote, lifting the wounded and loading them into the plane. But there was no light in their eyes, no recognition of anything beyond the simple task they were doing. None of these men were coming home. The wounded were worse. Rotted, frozen, purple-green, unbandaged wounds. These were the lucky ones. They were getting out. But how many of these would even survive the flight? A shudder ran through him as he did one last check of the cabin. Some of these men had fought in Belgium and in France. What had happened to that army? What had their nation become? Though Soviet forces held but the most tenuous hold on Stalingrad, Zhukov, who was now leading the defence, realised two things. The Germans were still not prepared for a Russian winter, and that they'd become completely myopic in their focus on Stalingrad. Their flanks were weak. They'd funnelled every German troop they could into the effort to take the city, leaving their flanks to be guarded by Romanian troops in the south, and a mixture of Romanian and Italian troops in the north. This meant that, while trying to attack the Germans in Stalingrad directly would result in incredible slaughter, and might not even see the Red Army make any gains, a two-pronged attack could crash through the Axis lines to the north and the south of the city and cut off the 6th Army. On the 19th, a massive force of over 1 million soldiers stormed across the Volga and smashed through the Romanian and Italian lines. The German front was being shredded. Huge gaps were appearing in the line. Worse still, the entire German 6th Army was trapped in Stalingrad, encircled, cut off from the rest of Army Group South. General Paulus, the commander of the 6th Army, pleaded with Hitler to be allowed to break out. Hitler refused. Members of the German General Staff took up the plea and implored Hitler to permit them to withdraw if they could. But Hitler said no. To him, Stalingrad was a contest of wills, and he would not be the first to blink. Hermann Göring, the chief of the Luftwaffe, and always one to feed Hitler's delusions, said that he could supply the encircled army entirely by air, that they could fight on indefinitely until another offensive could take place and the main German line could be pushed to the Volga again. Hitler seized on this, even as Paulus repeated his request. So the Luftwaffe began its great airlift campaign. To fully supply the army, they'd need to deliver at least 750 tons of material a day. They averaged 85. The army began to starve. Hitler ordered a rescue operation. A battalion of Tiger tanks would spearhead an effort to pierce the Soviet line and create a corridor to the 6th Army through which they could be resupplied. At first, the operation went well. The Germans were able to push through the Soviet defences and begin their drive on Stalingrad. But their strength was too little and the Soviet resistance too strong, as was the Soviet winter in the middle of December. They came to within 30 miles of the 6th Army. Manstein, head of Army Group South, begged Hitler to allow the 6th Army to attempt a breakout. If they threw all their strength at the Russians, there would be some small chance that they might be able to cut their way through and make it the 30 miles to meet up with the relief force. Then, the two groups could retreat together back to the German line. It would not be glorious, but it would be a chance, perhaps their last chance, to save hundreds of thousands of men. Hitler refused. Then, dire news came. The Soviets had renewed their offensive. The Italian forces had almost completely disintegrated. The relief force had to be recalled at once to shore up the main German line. The last chance for the 6th Army had passed. The German offensive in the south had stalled. The oil fields of Baku had not been taken. Stalingrad had not been conquered, and now the German army tried desperately to organise for defence. Meanwhile, the situation for the 6th Army grew progressively worse. Food ran out. Soon all the horses were eaten. Antiseptic, bandages and painkillers ran out, and accounts tell of wounded men being left out in the cold so they could die a better death than facing the long, painful agony of infection. Yet, still they fought their hopeless fight at the orders of their Führer. On the 8th of January, the Soviets came to offer Paulus terms. They offered honourable treatment for his men and treatment for his wounded. Paulus immediately sent the terms to Hitler, and Hitler just as quickly rejected them. On the 24th, the Soviets offered terms again. Paulus radioed to Hitler. Troops without ammunition or food. Effective command no longer possible. 18,000 wounded without any supplies or dressings or drugs. Further defence senseless. Collapse inevitable. Army requests immediate permission to surrender in order to save lives of remaining troops. Hitler replied, "Surrender is forbidden. 6th Army will hold their position to the last man and the last round, and by their heroic endurance will make an unforgettable contribution towards the establishment of a defensive front and the salvation of the Western world." At this point, he needed them to occupy the Soviets for as long as possible so he could withdraw the rest of his troops over the Don and restore his shattered line somewhere west of the Don River. By the 28th, the area held by the 6th Army was reduced to three small pockets around Stalingrad. The end couldn't be staved off much longer. And on the 30th, Paulus radioed in. Final collapse cannot be delayed more than 24 hours. Hitler's response was to shower the men with promotions, in hopes that this would spur them on to one last glorious act of self-sacrifice. He even promoted Paulus to Field Marshal, telling those safely behind the lines that no German Field Marshal had ever surrendered. So he hoped that by promoting Paulus it would inspire him, and his men would kill themselves rather than surrender, creating a heroic myth to be used as Nazi propaganda. But on the 31st, Paulus sent one last radio message. The 6th Army, true to their oath and conscious of the lofty importance of their mission, have held their position to the last man and the last round for Führer and Fatherland until the end. That night, the radio operator at the 6th Army headquarters sent one last message on his own. The Russians are at the door of our bunker. We are destroying our equipment. Followed by the letters CL, the international radio code for "this station will no longer transmit." The 6th Army surrendered. The age of German victories was past.